In a time of fake news, fake politicians, and fake fiat currency, it's getting harder to find the genuine article. That's why when it comes to precious metals, I call the team I can trust. This is David Knight for my friends at Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange. Proudly veteran-owned and operated, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange is your home for gold and silver coins, bullion, jewelry, and more. Prices and inventory are updated daily, so you get the most competitive possible pricing. And when it's time to sell your gold and silver items, they pay top dollar. Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange also accepts and deals in Bitcoin. Call or text the owner, Tony Arterburn, today at 888-667-1836. That's 888-667-1836. Or just go to wisewolf.gold. From bullion to Bitcoin, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Veteran of three foreign wars, entrepreneur, and warrior poet, Tony Arterburn takes on the issues facing our country, civilization, and planet. This is the Arterburn Radio Transmission.
Welcome to the Arterburn Radio Transmission. I'm your host, Tony Arterburn, broadcasting in studio with Beans the Brave. It's Friday, October 22nd, 2021. And folks, impromptu, last minute, my friend Don Jeffries decided to join the transmission because we need to get some paperback versions of Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. We need to get those sold because how this book does determines the fate of Hidden History 3, a pivotal work that's so important. We got to discuss that, Don. So this is really almost an emergency broadcast that you and I have put off for too long. So welcome to the program, Don. I want to give as much time to talk about this book because I read this long before you and I ever spoke. And this is one of those game changer books, especially as somebody who loves history like me. I've interviewed you about your other books, but never about this one. So let's dive in. Thanks for joining us, by the way.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Tony. It's wonderful to be here with you.
So you're the author of Hidden History, and that book, that to me is, it really lays the groundwork intellectually for proofs of not only a nefarious conspiracy, but a systematic plan inside that conspiracy. And you lay it out with footnotes and with research. And that's been a game changer for me. When you release Crimes and Cover-Ups, I mean, obviously the first day it was out, I bought it. So I was a fan long before we ever talked. This is one of those subjects when you talk about pre-1963, because, you know, when you start off Hidden History, you talk about the mother of all conspiracies, and that's the JFK assassination. But conspiracies existed long before that, and cover-ups existed long before that. So you really dive into going back to the founding of the country. Did you have a plan to do this prequel while you were writing Hidden History, or did that just come up later, in the aftermath?
It was in the back of my mind. And I already, like, for instance, the part about the Lindbergh kidnapping, I had written that a long time ago because I was very interested in that. And other parts of it, the Lincoln stuff, I just compiled notes on that when I was reading Thomas DiLorenzo's work and things like that. And so there was an idea I wanted to do something like that. And it just kind of made sense, you know, because a lot of people reminded me that, you know, obviously it didn't begin with the JFK assassination. So this was kind of, this is a prequel to Hidden History. And I thought, well, there's so much, you know, untapped material there. And really, other than Thomas DiLorenzo, no one talked about Lincoln, and the founding fathers are just being besmirched everywhere. So nobody is standing up for them anymore. So I just, I figured this would be the perfect book.
One of the themes that flows through the book, and we could talk about this too throughout the show, but if anybody who's read it or anybody listened to the audio book, which is a great audio production, by the way, just the, if you know, obviously I want you to go get the paperback because that's going to help Don out. It's going to help get this message out, and it's going to determine the fate of Hidden History 3, at least the publisher, right? But the audio book's great. And I just remember I turned to my wife. We were driving up to our land in the, when we lived in San Antonio, we'd take these long drives. We listened to this book. And she even mentioned, she's like, wow. She's like, this guy does not like Abraham Lincoln. And I said, no, he doesn't. And it made me laugh because I was thinking the same thing when she brought it up. I'm like, he's just kicking the absolute crap out of Abraham Lincoln, which is good, by the way, because if you really dive into history, and that's why this kind of work is so important, you start to see like, wow, that he was a tyrant, you know, like, I think you, didn't you start off, wasn't it Hidden History where you talked about, his Secretary of State that had a bell on his desk that he would be able to ring and, to have someone arrested who was a dissident, right?
Yes. As John Seward. And, he used to brag when people would come into the office, he would you know, point to the bell and say, I can have that, you know, I can ring and have anybody arrested anywhere that I'm in. So, this was, and it as bad as Lincoln was, people like Seward and especially the radical Republicans in the Congress like Thaddeus Stevens, people like that, were just totally demented. They were almost at the woke level in many ways, especially for their time. So Lincoln was actually considered not quite radical enough for them in many respects. And I think eventually those are the people that did conspire with Edwin Stanton as Secretary of War to assassinate him.
Yeah, it's funny. I've learned to look at history a lot differently after reading your books. And I'm somebody who's read history most of my adult life. But you brought up some points like we have a play that's really popular in this country. All the celebrities, it's very chic to go to see Hamilton, right? But no one would ever put on a production called Jefferson. Right. They would never do that because Hamilton's the banker's founding father. Right. And so you make the case like there's never been a major movie production on 1776, never about the founding. And then they pick these certain figures. So you turn a lot of these things on its head. Like we idolize Lincoln and we demonize somebody like Robert E. Lee. Right. So Robert E. Lee was not for slavery. Robert E. Lee detested it, you know, and had a conscience and was wrecked by things. But Lincoln, on the other hand, he said, you know, if I could free the slaves and save the Union, I would. If I could free half of them and save the Union, I would. If I free none and save the Union, I would. And so, again, history written by the victors, right? And that's why it's so important to have work like this. And I think, you know, wasn't it Henry Ford that said history is bunk? And Napoleon said that it was a pack of lies agreed upon. So that's why, I turn to people like you, spent your life looking into the alternative. You're no stranger to this. I mean, when you talked about in Hidden History, holding the Carcano rifle, you know, Mannlicher Carcano, back in the assassination board back in the, was that
75 as a teenager. Yep.
Yeah. As a teenager holding that and going to the archives and being present at so many, you know, you're walking through history and then writing history. So, let's start off on the book though, because I don't want to get lost too much in the conversation of, and we don't even have a commercial break on this show. So this is just straight through. We're on WWCR and our podcast. I'm going to put this up everywhere. We're streaming live on Rockfin. Welcome all the folks on Rockfin. Chapter one is the birth of the Republic. And of course you have a wonderful, introduction by a forward, actually, by Ron Paul. Yes. Kind of, you know, footnotes and, you know, broad picture here. You start off at in 1776, birth of the Republic. What are you looking for in the founding of the United States? What's the first crime and cover up you see?
Well, I think, you know, really in that section, I'm mainly trying to show that the founders have been misrepresented, and to show, I mean, I'm a fanboy of the founders. Although, to be honest with you, if I had been around at that time with my inclinations, I would have been along with Patrick Henry and George Mason originally, Jefferson and people like that who were suspicious of the Constitution when they eventually got around. I mean, I you know, was probably sympathizing with the Articles of Confederation. But, of course, what happened is, thanks to Mason, especially, we got the wonderful Bill of Rights, which is really what makes the Constitution great, is that Bill of Rights. Without the Bill of Rights, not so great. Because, you know, it doesn't – and of course, that's – I think that's what – especially now, why that section of the book is very important, because you see how under attack the Constitution is. But it's under attack because of the Bill of Rights. If the Constitution didn't have that Bill of Rights, I don't think they would – pay a whole lot of attention to it, because that's what makes it important, is that, and especially now in today's climate, the fact that these were God-given rights, as they delineated, these are not rights granted in the government, which of course then could be taken away. Founders are very careful to say, no, these are the rights you're born with, they're given to you by God. And of course, the problem we come into today is that, I don't know, it might be a majority of Americans, but certainly millions of Americans no longer believe in God. So they wouldn't, they don't have any affinity for God-given rights, because to them it's meaningless. What do you mean God-given rights? What are you talking about? So that's the problem we get into when we're trying to argue in some cases. And I've argued with people about freedom of speech and things like that, and that's a white thing. And I'll say, what? You don't want freedom of speech? I mean, and it's that's where we are today. And that's why I think it's very important to understand what they intended. And if you look at, I also have a section in there, which is very true, is these were people who were not chicken hawks. These were people that walked the walk. And, you know, in terms of people like Washington, they actually led the troops in battle and risked their own lives. But lots of these people, and I have a section of it, that they did risk their fortunes, because they were the one percenters of their time. So they risked their wealth, and many of them lost their wealth. Many of them died, lost their homes, and so forth. So they did risk something. They weren't just, you know, cavalier ivory tower, you know, elites that were just talking about a concept. They went for it, and they because this is, that's why, you know, the apocryphal tale that John Hancock, I mean, he signed his name very big for some reason. So I think it's very a colorful anecdote to say that he signed it so big because he wanted George III to be able to read it without his glasses. And Hancock, again, was one of the richest men in America. And just imagine having one percenters like that now. I mean, you look at the awful billionaires we have around it. And that's what made the war for independence work, because it would never have worked if all the farmers and clerks or whatever kind of workers you had at that time, the agrarian society, they could never have, because they didn't have the power, they didn't have the influence. So you needed incredibly rich men like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson to be behind it. So I think, you know, the real crime and, you know, and cover up there is their legacy has been, as you noted, Hollywood has never done, and that's when I really first started noticing it as a young guy. It's like, you know, why don't we have like an old, you know, I love old movies. I love the golden age of Hollywood. They never did a picture on George Washington, our country. They never did a picture of Thomas Jefferson, the Adamses, Patrick Henry. They did do a film about Alexander Hamilton. Even then, he was their favorite, because Hamilton was the banker's favorite founder, and he also was the father. But you would understand that, especially he was the father of debt. You know, he was the one that, you know, that during the debate said, hey, you know, he argued for the federal government to absorb all the debts from the states during the war for independence. And just obviously a disastrous thing. And the early years of the Republic, and I go into that a little bit. Thomas DiLorenzo wrote a great book about it, too, about Jefferson versus Hamilton. And he, you know, we were the same mindset, definitely. But you talk about in the early days, that was the difference between the Federalists, who Hamilton represented, and the Democratic Republicans. They hadn't separated yet, that Jefferson represented. It was about debt. And it was about especially that central bank, which Jefferson and his followers were against, and Hamilton was pushing big time. And again, I think that explains more than anything else why he's a hip black young Broadway star.
Right. I mean, you got a chapter. I was just looking over the book. I bought the Kindle version before we went live because I know I have a hardback somewhere, right? And I have the audio book, and I rebought another paperback because I'm going to do my part. I thought about doing it live, but like I can't fiddle with all the keys. But you have a chapter on the slandering of Jefferson. And I remember this, and this is what I kind of open up the conversation, but you're so correct. By the way, before we go and you answer that, I know in this book somewhere, pretty sure you talked about the poor guy who did the pro-revolutionary American Revolutionary film during World War One?
Yeah, World War One, I think. Yeah,
right. And it showed anti-British sentiment, so the guy was not able to release it. I mean, you talk about censorship and draconian tyranny. I mean, that you know, really starts. I mean, the 20th century is full of this, but it really starts under Wilson and the war powers and all that. But that's like the only attempt that was ever made, you know, and the guy goes to jail for it.
He was canceled early. And I think, you know, early, even then, and I think that's why I talked so much about, I juxtapose what happened under Lincoln with the founding of the country, because the American Revolution was fought for two main principles. One, the first and foremost, was the consent of the governed. The whole idea was that, you know, people have a right, because the colonists did not consent to English rule any longer. So they seceded from the rule, which, of course, it makes it ironic what happened, you know, 90 years later or whatever, but or less than that. So they believe that all people everywhere, this is a revolutionary concept, that, you know, people have a right to consent to those who government. And if this no longer works for them, as Jefferson said, they have a right to alter or abolish it. So they talked very clearly about that. Certainly this wasn't a sacrosanct union. This wasn't something that was inviolate that you could never leave. I mean, the whole idea was that if it doesn't work for you anymore, you know, go ahead and abolish it and form something else, which is what those Southern states tried to do in 1860. But once Lincoln pushed the war that he did, and almost a million Americans were killed, and the United States, I tell this to people all the time, you look at references to the United States before the Civil War, and the United States was always plural. The United States are. After the Civil War, it became singular and has been that way ever since. The United States is. And that was the huge victory. And again, it was basically the victory of the Federalists under Hamilton over those Democratic Republicans. Because the Democratic Republicans early on, they wanted states' rights and they wanted a loose, most of them didn't even trust the Constitution. That's why they liked the Articles of Confederation, because that just basically established, okay, you know, these are sovereign, basically sovereign states that are kind of coming together, a loose confederation that have common interest. But we don't recognize any kind of real strong federal government. And the Constitution created a stronger federal government, but it protects and balances it with the Bill of Rights. It became, I think, wonderful. But that was the, the argument. That was the debate then. And with Lincoln coming in and shattering all that. I mean, Lincoln, you know, is the first president to overstep his constitutional authority. Over and over again, he created the imperial presidency that we've come to know and love, and the court historians certainly love it, because all the greatest presidents, we're told, are the imperial presidents. You look who are at the top of the list. It's Lincoln, FDR, Wilson, Theodore Roosevelt, people like that. Those are the great presidents. Obama will probably be ranked pretty high. I think he already is. But so somebody like Jefferson, obviously, keeps sinking. We used to be ranked high, but he's not any longer. And JFK is sunk down as well, because, you know, he ran afoul of them too. That's why they had to kill him. But so really, Lincoln did not. And that's why it's so ironic when you hear so many misguided conservatives and patriots that kind of lump Lincoln together in with Washington and Jefferson and the founders. And it's kind of a patriotic thing, great men and stuff. Now, you know, Lincoln contradicted them, and Lincoln hated the founding fathers. I go into that in this book. But, most people don't know that. He especially despised Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson would have despised him, I can tell you that. And so we need to think of that. You know, we're taught when people who are rooting and saying, you know, the good guys won in the Civil War, well, just think about how many of those founding fathers would have been with the Confederacy. And I think you're probably looking at most of them. And now the Adamses, who were good people, they probably wouldn't have been, because they were already abolitionists. I mean, they were, so they may have bought that idea, and they probably would have stuck with the North. I would hope anyhow that they wouldn't have pushed for war. But certainly all of those Virginia presidents, every one of them, would have been with the Confederacy and would have been with Virginia. So we need to think about that. We're talking, of course, not to the modern person, they would just say, yeah, see, that just shows they're all racist, you know, and that's their idea there. But the conservatives especially need to, because they make them take too much of, and they certainly idolize Lincoln. The Republicans idolize him. And really, look what he did. He set all the precedents. Every one of the precedents that we see were Woodrow Wilson. You know, Woodrow Wilson throwing those World War I protesters in jail was based on Lincoln suspending the writ of habeas corpus and throwing untold thousands of Northerners in jail with that charges. And look what we see today with the January 6th people. I mean, that they don't even have to cite any precedent anymore, because we're under such total control that nobody even cares. There's no legal reason for anything most of the time. If they had to, they would cite Lincoln's precedent. Because what they're doing to those January 6th defendants, in essence, they have suspended the writ of habeas corpus for them, because they've held them for months. And a lot of them went out bail and treated them horribly. But we can, again, thank Lincoln for that. You can thank, you know, the FDR interring Japanese Americans and German Americans and Italian Americans, and they didn't get any reparations. They weren't publicized. But he did that, again, based on Wilson's actions in imprisoning World War I protesters. Of course, Wilson acted on the precedent sent by Lincoln, even all the way down to the treatment of the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay by the W. Bush administration. And they directly cited Lincoln's precedent for doing that. So he's not one of my heroes, and I don't think he should be a hero to any thinking American.
No, it's funny too, because, you know, modern politicians, presidents, the establishment, they all invoke, like, the worst presidents. They invoke Lincoln or FDR, and these are tyrants. These are people that trampled on the Constitution, trampled on tradition, trampled on the rule of law, and were warmongers, you know, enhancing the power of the state. But that's what they go to, right? And you can always tell a lot about a person, what their affinity is for what founding father or historical figure. You almost never hear anyone, you know, touting like the wisdom of John Quincy Adams, like, you know, America's not designed to go abroad in search of monsters to destroy, like that great wisdom that is never talked about in our circles, because we have to have a, you know, more war, more open borders, more free trade, destructive free trade deals, all these things that enhance multinationals. It is so, again, this is like everything that people get taught in the public schools, these indoctrination centers, is literally the opposite of what you need to know. I mean, you talk about Jefferson. Why is he so demonized? Why does he have to be taken down a peg? Every time he's brought up in the news, it's always followed by, oh, well, you know, he fathered children with Sally Hemings, which you talk about in your book. You know, has that ever been proven? Is that really a fact? Do we really, really know that? Is that, you know, it was hearsay? And he also, you know, people say, well, that was written about. And I'm like, well, you know, I think John Adams, you know, because they were rivals for a while, I think John Adams put out that rumor. But yeah. I think, well, didn't Jefferson say that that John Adams was a hermaphrodite? Do we talk about that? I mean, it's just like these different rumors spinning around, but that he has to be taken down a peg, because what he believed in was a decentralized small republics. You know, he wouldn't have dreamed of the Industrial Revolution, the cities that we have today, this loss, because the bigger the government, the smaller the citizen. And now is everything is giant, right? And we just feel like, look at that, like you brought up the January 6th people. Oh, we don't have to agree with their motives or to stop the steal or anything to realize that when you can just be imprisoned in this country. And somebody tweeted out today, I think it was National File, they were saying, you know, from the time OJ murdered, right, well, he wasn't convicted for it, the time that the murder that he committed, and then the time of his acquittal was 15 months. But those people that are being held right now are going to be in jail before their trial. Before, like, this is insane. We're reaching this clown world proportions. But that has to do with what we invoke. Like, they use terms like insurrection, right, for protests and things like, I mean, this is the authoritarian, and those people love Lincoln, right? Those people love FDR, war powers. This is where it gets dangerous. And that's why you bringing this up is so important.
Yeah. Well, just this last week, I think it was, you saw an example of Bill de Blasio, you know, an example of an awful, odious politician. He's changed his name a couple of times, comes from, you know, born with a silver spoon in his mouth, typical leader that we have, born on third base, thinks he'd home run. Not a man of the people anyway, just a horrible human being. He oversaw the taking down of the statue of Thomas Jefferson that had been there for, I think, 200 years, I don't know, something ridiculous amount of time, I guess, in their statutory hall in New York. And just reading the quotes in a news story I saw from some of these just putrid assembly people, at the, you know, in New York, it's just unbelievable. They call Jefferson a pedophile. In addition to being, and I go into this a little bit, the Sally Hemings thing. Even if you buy the DNA, which was very dubious, but those DNA tests showed that A. Jefferson, male, which I think there were at least 26 in the area at the time. A. Jefferson male fathered one of her children, had several children, but the Jeffersons were excluded from several others by testing, including the one that Sally Hemings bore when I think she was 16. So certainly someone with a 16-year-old back then would certainly, it's inaccurate to label them a pedophile now for a 16-year-old, it's a completely different term. But back then, a 16-year-old woman getting married was very, very common. And so that would have been ridiculous to even say that or to give birth. But that particular child, the DNA results eliminated Jefferson from possibly fathering her child when she was an underage girl. But they continue to act as if it didn't. And it's very difficult because the disinformation and misinformation out there is so heavy. And now the drumbeat that he's a racist. And if you just read those comments, I mean, you can see how it's increased in the last 15, 20 years when it really, I think it was Fawn Brody that was the first one that wrote a psychological, you know, one of her absurd psychobiographies or something where she analyzed Jefferson. And of course, she determined he was a pretty bad character naturally. And, but just the idea, even if some of this were true, it doesn't, contradict the fact or eliminate the fact that he was the most classical liberal of his age who produced a timeless work in the Declaration of Independence and just whose sayings and it was were so profound that whose writings were profound and who was, you know, fantastic architect and inventor in addition to all that. And even if all this was true, which I think, again, there's very little reason to believe it all is, and it's politically correct nonsense in my view, but to have, when you see people, elected officials that are calling the author of the Declaration of Independence a racist, worthless pedophile whose image should be, you know, where nobody can see it any longer, what does that say? I mean, they're swearing it up, to uphold the Constitution, supposedly. So that's what people need to understand, is the people that are in charge at all levels have not only don't support what the founding fathers implemented, they despise them, except again for Alexander Hamilton, who they love because he wanted a central bank and he invented the concept of debt and he would have fit right in. He'd be a member of the CFR if he were around today, undoubtedly.
Yes, he'd be a member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yes, he would.
I've loved Jefferson from a young age. My dad always talked about Thomas Jefferson, and my dad, an entrepreneur, and loved the founding of the country. And I got that alternative history. He was a young man, but I remember being in Iraq, and I read like 200 books in Iraq. I love diving into biography and American history. And I just promised myself, like, if I make it through here, I just want to go and I want to spend a day at Monticello. And I don't know if you've ever been to Monticello. If you've ever been to,
I haven't, which is ridiculous. As close as it is, I've been to Mount Vernon many times. I need to go to Monticello.
I don't know how it is now, but I went back in 2004, and it's just beautiful. Like the grounds and everything, and you can feel the history. I don't know what they've done to it. I mean, I'm hoping it's the same, but I, like everything else in this country, what they've done to the Alamo, which is a whole different conversation, what they're doing all around the country to museums and taking things, I don't know. But that is, to me, was sacred ground. And this is like the people that I've identified with. because they were about liberty and about, being able to self-actualize and be your best self. That's why this history is so important, because we get taught this conformity, marching along with the state. It's really dangerous, you know, like this, all this stuff that we're, that's being taught now. Now they're just tearing everything down. So it doesn't really, I don't know what their goal is, just destruction. It's kind of like the Solzhenitsyn quote, you know, to destroy a people, first sever their roots. That's what's going. This is pure satanic Marxism, in my opinion. Let's talk about Benjamin Franklin, which is another whole chapter you have in here. And I know that was it the Hellfire Club that you kind of dive into, and some of the mysteries surrounding that? Jog my memory, because it's been a little while since I listened to the book. But
Franklin, I'm kind of ambivalent about, because I admire many things about him. Obviously, incredibly brilliant guy, and he even more a renowned inventor than Jefferson was. Clearly a brilliant man. There's no question about it. A man of many, many talents. Poor Richard's Almanac and all that, and all the little sayings he invented. And of course, my favorite saying of his is one that's never quoted, and that is that there's never been such a good thing. There's no such thing as a good war or a bad peace. I think everybody ought to remember that. So that's my favorite Franklin quote. But he was a very different kind of character personally. He ended up being ostracized by his son, you know, the guy that we've seen in pictures with the kite, the electrical experiments. Well, that little boy ended up as a loyalist to the crown, and they never spoke. It's very sad. They never spoke afterwards. And so they're, kind of in a port into things to come as far as dysfunctional America. So that's the kind of thing that's very common. People not talking over Trump or whatever, but he was in terms of the Hellfire Club. It was an unlikely looking, you know, playboy, but apparently that's what he was. Apparently he had quite the libido, and despite the look he had, apparently, I guess his money and his fame, he courted lots of women. But in his spare time, he joined a group called the Hellfire Club, which was blasphemous as far as I can tell. I mean, they supposedly had women, that prostitutes that would come dressed as nuns. You know, again, the fact that they were dressed as nuns, that kind of tells you, you know, the bent, the club, you know, why would you need them dressed as nuns unless you're trying to be blasphemous? And again, a bunch of one percenters were, activities were held far underground underneath an old Benedictine monk's abbey that had been abandoned. So, supposedly that expression that later Aleister Crowley, one of the foremost Satanists of modern times, his credo is do what thou will. And supposedly that phrase originated by the Hellfire Club, do what thou will. So it tells you all you need to know about that. And of course, I'm very interested also, and I wrote about the human remains that were found in the home that Benjamin Franklin lived in London in the late 1700s. And I think the 90s, 1990s, they were excavating there, and they found a number of human remains in the walls in that home. And so to me, I thought that, you know, it should have gotten a little more scrutiny, but unlike, let's say, if they had found human remains in the walls at Monticello, I think it would have been looked at a little bit differently.
Agreed.
You know, they would undoubtedly said that they were probably the remains of all the slave women that Jefferson raped and then killed. I'm guessing that would be the narrative. But in the case of Franklin, they scrambled, and I have the quotes from the media reports and everything, scrambled to quickly distance him from it. It couldn't have been him. You know, he couldn't have known. And you know, I don't know that he did. And their explanation that it was a young guy that lived there at the time, I guess, I don't know, living with Franklin or renting a room from or something, was doing experiments apparently on, I guess, cadavers at the time. They used to have grave robbers and all that. They were, you know, a lot of, you know, things that were going on back then we would look at now. But and so the idea was that these were medical experiments or robots or something, and somehow Franklin didn't know anything about it. Of course, that doctor too, he died, under mysterious circumstances, very young as well. You know, so I just kind of throw that in there because that happens so often with these events. And so I think that's just interesting. But just to see how they went into cover-up mode, you know, 200 years later, 200 plus years later, again, I don't know that, you know, there was anything sinister going on, that, you know, Franklin was killing people or whatever. I don't say that. But I do say that there's no reason to just kind of have a knee-jerk response of, well, he didn't know anything. We don't know what he knew. So, I mean,
he's kind of an enigma, you know, and I'm this is one of the funny parts of the chapter, but, you know, he inserted the line in the pursuit of happiness into the Declaration of Independence because originally it was life, liberty, and property. And he said, sounds too harsh. And you know, there's a connotation of slavery and all that. So let's do the pursuit of happiness. And then you brought up that he later uses this as a supposedly as a pickup line.
That's what the rumor was. I mean, just imagine that. Would you like to you care to join me in the pursuit of happiness? I mean, that's almost too good to be true. I mean, it's just hard to picture, you know, but that's apparently so. I guess, you know, in some ways you gotta kinda be amused by that. So and of course Franklin was married all that time as well, too. He had a kind of a long suffering wife. I think was sickly most of the time. So he was quite the libertine, as they call him. But I do have a little mixed feelings about him because I admire so much about him. But I'm not sure, you know, because, you know, because the Hellfire Club, there's some indication that it was like just a really blasphemous offshoot of the Masons. So, you know, he's connected to the Freemasons. And of course, there's so much of that thread running through those early years as well, too. And the Illuminati, you know, which I talk about in there, that was a real thing. It came, you know, Illuminati was formed the exact same year, the Declaration of Independence, 1776, by Adam Weishaupt, who did exist. He was a real person. Both Jefferson and Washington wrote about it. We had their correspondence. So for people that poo-poo that idea, no, this is, you know, this is a real thing. The question
Let's talk about you have a whole chapter on it. And Adam Weishaupt, real person, Illuminati, May 1st, 1776. Same timeline as the American Revolution. And of course, you know, now that's celebrated. May Day is a, you know, the worldwide Workers' Day, communist roots and all that. Lots to unpack there. But what your chapter in Crimes and Cover-Ups, what do you go into?
Yeah, well, I quote from him and Jefferson. Again, I love Jefferson, but Jefferson was a free thinker, maybe sometimes a little too free thinking. And he really despised organized religion. And he, you know, this is a guy who wrote, you know, tried to take out the parts of the Bible he liked. I mean, you know, so he wasn't a perfect guy. But he was sympathetic towards Weishaupt because Weishaupt was a big free thinker. And he was, you know, he was promoting something that would have, you know, really exposed, I guess, organized religion, which I think Jefferson wanted to do as well. So Jefferson was sympathetic to him. And his letters reveal that. I think he was really shockingly naive about it. Whereas Washington was more concerned about, you know, this is, you know, we want to kind of, we don't want necessarily Freemasonry connected with this because he was infiltrating the lodges. And that was his first attempt. And then, of course, later you mentioned John Quincy Adams. And I talk about, I have all his quotes there. Very few historians are talking about that. But John Quincy Adams, once the Illuminati really infested Freemasonry, they appear to have changed it. And John Quincy Adams, for one, really bought into the anti-Mason party, which was pretty powerful in the United States for a while. And Adams became the leader of the anti-Mason party. And I quote extensively from his writings. And, you know, he talks just like any conspiracy theorist you might hear today. And talked about the secret oaths and things like that. But certainly Weishaupt was a real person. So I think the only question is, did the Illuminati die out with Weishaupt, or did it continue? And did it infiltrate everything? And is this, you know, because we talk about something is above these political leaders. They're definitely not in charge. Somebody's pulling their strings. And we can say it's the bankers or the Jews or the whatever, you know, people, they have their favorite, you know, culprit that they want to name. But I think the most likely suspect is something like the Illuminati, some kind of group that's where there's people that are super elite above all others. And there's, you know, who knows how many people there, you know, the ruling families and all these things that were rumors that just a tiny handful of people rule. So I think the Illuminati probably came out of that to whatever extent is there. And maybe they don't call themselves that. But so I think they're very important to look at what they were saying back then, because it certainly, I think, has become reflected today's world, when clearly something, and I have a bunch of quotes there, as I'm sure you know, and I think in the introduction, where I talk about all these leaders, for, you know, all people like Bill Clinton, to talk about something, the powers behind the scenes, that someone's, they're all acknowledging it. FDR, all these people. So they pretty much told you, we're not in charge. And so I think that's very important to note that something is behind the scenes. Something's above it all. And I think the Illuminati is probably your best candidate.
I agree with you. I think they have their own religion. I think there's things they don't even, there's levels of power that aren't even disclosed to the public. Like we have to go find if there's even available for us to uncover it, because obviously something else is in charge, right? You don't look at, I call them meat puppets. You look at the leaders of the so-called free world, right? We're all being locked down and having our futures taken away from us and the controlled demolition of all of our economies. And they just have these disheveled morons. You know, like you roll out, I mean, I can't even stand to look at Boris Johnson, but he says the same lines as Castro's son, Trudeau, up in Canada. Who's, they all say build back better. And then Biden's campaign and then his infrastructure act. And then this Australians say the same thing. It's like, who is running this, right? And so they have the same talking points, and this has never happened before. And that's why, like, going in reverse and looking at like how we got to this point is so key. That's why I love your work. And like looking into cause and effect, you know, somebody asked me yesterday, like, when do you think we lost our liberty? Like, when do you think it was, like, when did the United States not have autonomy? I'm like, somewhere around like the late 19th century, something started to change. And you see, like, with the adoption of the Federal Reserve. Do you talk about the Fed? I'm sure in this book. I mean, I read so much of your stuff, but I'm sure you brought it up. Before we get to that, though, we talked about Lincoln. And folks, if you buy the book, you're going to just there's so much to unpack here. You can't do it in an hour. But I wanted you to touch on. Before we get, I wanted to cover this and maybe talk about maybe McKinley, maybe Joe McCarthy. I know you covered that in here. Sure. Maybe a little bit of FDR. The Lincoln assassination. There is some strangeness around the Lincoln assassination that is not in mainline court historians. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, and that's the odd thing. It's very much like Martin Luther King in some ways. And of course, I still admire Martin Luther King, but. Both like Lincoln, he gets, you know, good press generally still, but the same historians that give him good press have no interest in his assassination. Same way with Lincoln. Lincoln is the sacred cow. He's the secular saint of our civilization, but they have never honestly investigated his assassination because I think it was a clear inside job. It was, you know, they would try to, you know, blame Jefferson Davis and the Confederates. That was ridiculous. Lincoln actually, they actually would have preferred Lincoln to a more radical Republican, as bad as he was. So I think that for whatever reason, there was maybe an inside power struggle between Edwin Stanton, who was a psychotic radical Republican. He just, you know, really, you read about him. He was pretty much demented. And he was a tyrant that kind of bullied Lincoln at times. He was a Secretary of War. He was running this show. And his actions, he orchestrated the cover up. And you can read the chapter of my book, but there's lots and lots of reasons to suspect many, many mysterious deaths afterwards. And the fact John Wilkes Booth's body, it's a supposed body in Bryn Mawr Cemetery, still not been exhumed, even though his family has wanted that body exhumed for a very long time. And generally speaking, it's the family's wishes that rule the day. Those cases, but not in this case, because unless it can is to solve a historical mystery, and if you they can have DNA evidence now, so they do DNA on whoever is buried in John Wilkes Booth's grave, and they determine it's not John Wilkes Booth. Those are one of those little dominoes that, you know, it may not seem significant to us now, but it is, because again, it exposes, and these the same court historians that are so vested in, you know, 9/11 and the JFK assassination and everything. They're also vested in those older mysteries as well, and they have to poo-poo any and all conspiracy theories. So if those conspiracy theories turned out to be right, Finus Bates and people like that wrote about John Wilkes Booth escaping and living until, you know, 1903 or something, they ridiculed them at the time, and they still ridicule them when they're ever mentioned. So they would have such an egg on their face, and I think, you know, we talk about conspiratorial stuff. I we can never underestimate just the human factor here, human nature, and especially the people that aren't high-level conspirators, and most of them aren't. They're just going along with the cover-up. They're following orders, and they don't even realize they're just, you know, showing that they're really good and brainwashed, and so they trust them to do the right thing, and they always do. They're loyal soldiers, and they stay on the plantation. But they are the ones who are so vested and so you know, against, antagonistic towards so-called conspiracy theorists. They will never admit that we were right on any of these issues. Even something like that is significant, because then if you do that, then you peel that back and you realize, well, okay, so they didn't kill John Wilkes Booth and Garrett's Barn. Okay, so that was all a lie. So who did they kill? And what does this say about a plot to kill Kennedy? I mean, it's a plot to kill Lincoln. So then you start looking at the other questions there, and why did they execute the prisoners they did, including Mary Surratt, who was a middle-aged woman, and they hung her. Which is just mind-boggling, especially when her only crime was owning the boarding house where John Wilkes Booth supposedly met with her son, who curiously wasn't tried and escaped. And when he finally came back, he became a noted lecturer on the assassination. He was never tried. And so these are the things that I think if you look at, they don't want you to overturn too many, because these are domino effects. And I say it about the thing that, JFK assassination, starts dominoing towards MLK and RFK and Capaquiddick and all the other Kennedys, JFK Jr. Even something as recently as Seth Rich, you peel that back down. Well, that goes back to WikiLeaks. That goes back to the Russia nonsense, that Pizzagate, all that. These are all interconnected. So they have a powerful interest in making sure all of them remain hidden. So they don't want the so-called conspiracy theorists to be right on anything. And as James Forrestal, Secretary of War under Truman, said before they pushed him out of a window at Bethesda Naval Hospital, he told his friend Joe McCarthy, who had died at Bethesda Naval Hospital a few years later under mysterious circumstances as well, he told him, if this wasn't a giant conspiracy, once in a while they'd make a mistake in our favor. And just as likely, once in a while, the so-called wacky conspiracy theorists would be right. Maybe we get one right here or there, but no, they can't have us ever be right, because then these things are connected. And so that's why even something like the Lincoln assassination seems irrelevant now, but it isn't. I had a chapter on Jack the Ripper that I was going to include in this, but I ended up deleting it myself, and I ended up having the work published in the Garrison Journal. It's published by my friend S.T. Patrick. People can find my work in there. I've written it. It's a quarterly journal. It's a lot of good stuff. But something like that from 1888, the murder of prostitutes, there are still files that are classified for that.
Right.
So why? Why would that possibly be? So they have a vested interest because these things are all connected. In that case, I think we know why, because the royal family was involved. There's no other reason, some kind of royal involvement. Otherwise, it wouldn't happen. World War I. There's still files classified from World War I. Why? So people talk about the JFK assassination. Forget it. You still have World War I files classified. There's no reason for them, since they claim there's never any conspiracies and that we're crazy. Why is anything classified? Why is anything involved with national security when you said there's never any state interest? It's always some wacky lone nut. But nobody asked these questions, and that's what I'm trying to do in my own little way.
Can you imagine just being a court historian, how painful it must be for them that they can't connect any meaning to history? Like, it's all accidents and it's all a lone nut. Like every yes. single it's just random. They must be terrified. What's the next thing that's going to cause this major upheaval? Yes. It's all random. There's no plan. See, that's the thing. I said the other day, it was like conspiracy research is just history with common sense in it. And that's you're just looking at patterns and saying, oh, I see where this is causation, which brings me to the McKinley assassination. You talked about this in Crimes and Cover-Ups. Is it Czolgosz, right? The anarchist.
Right.
So weird circumstances there. I remember the story, from just reading regular, where he comes in, he's got a big cast on his hand. This is what, 1901? Or 1900. Okay. So it's 1901. Teddy Roosevelt, they put him in the vice presidency to get rid of him, right? Yep. Because he was governor of New York. They made him the vice president. He's very young and active. And they said, we'll get rid of him over here in the VP slot. Czolgosz, this immigrant, anarchist, the anarchist at the time would be kind of like was that almost like a proto Marxist in some ways, or some kind of a revolutionary?
I think maybe so. They handled some of the similar, even though it's because the anarchists want no rule. you know, no order. But again, there's a crossover there. But yeah, they're the real radical sub their day.
So he comes in. He's got this, you know, firearm built into this cast. He shoots McKinley. It takes like weeks for McKinley to die. He was in agony. I know it was just a terrible death. But you started putting the pattern together. Like, how did this guy? Who funded his stay? Like, he had cash on him. What's the story there? Just kind of a.
Yeah, well, this same thing we see in so many of these so-called lone nuts. I mean, the Harvey Oswald was certainly seemed to go places where he couldn't afford it, all the way down to people like Mark David Chapman, who allegedly shot John Lennon, and John Hinckley, allegedly shot Reagan. They didn't appear to have the financial wherewithal to be traveling as they did. To have these, so and when people ask these questions, you know, they, certainly in the case of Czolgosz, he seemed to be a support anarchist, and you even had like early indications. And again, I refresh my memory having written about it, but I believe that's the one case where McKinley curiously didn't have the protection around him he should have had. It seemed that's to have brilliant. Broken out, a la JFK later, yeah. And McKinley's case, one of the forgotten novelists of our time who was really great was Taylor Caldwell, who was a real conspiracy theorist. That's probably why she's been forgotten. Her most famous work was Captains and Kings, which was made into a big miniseries on television way back, and they never would allow it now. It's very conspiratorial. And she speculated in her fiction that McKinley, she directly speculated Kit McKinley was assassinated by Theodore Roosevelt, who was a real imperialist and a racist, by the way, by any modern standard at all. Certainly no progressive that I would recognize. Put him in the office. And her theory, and I believe it's probably true, is that during the Spanish-American War of 1898, McKinley had been insufficiently welcoming of that. He actually questioned it. He balked a little at it. Now eventually they bulldozed him over and did what they wanted to do. But I think he was a little too he wasn't quite under their control. That's my impression anyhow. And I think they wanted this this firebrand Teddy Roosevelt in there, who again I'm very critical of in my book as well.
Yes, the thing about McKinley too, Don, is 1898. You have the Spanish-American War. He had a nervous breakdown. They pushed him so hard because he was a Civil War veteran, and that was the longest gap we'd ever had, by the way, in American history, where we didn't really have a major war. And because so many people had died, close to a million, right? It was this massive bloodletting. And McKinley just said, he just kept saying, I couldn't decide. He was back and forth, because this was going to create, in his mind, he's having memories of fighting in an actual battle. And I think that that's could be a great causation for he wasn't their person. Like they needed a more imperialistic, expansionist, president, which would be TR. But McKinley wanted no part in that. Of course he acquiesced, but that may not have been enough. That's interesting.
No, I think that, and that's what Taylor Caldwell felt again. And she's never mentioned now. She didn't die until probably the '80s, maybe even later. But so her books were bestsellers, through the 70s and I think into the 80s. And she had the miniseries, The Captains and the Kings, which was very well known in its day. But you're not going to see reruns of that ever, because again, she was in real life. She was with the spotlight, the American Free Press. I write for that now. But the spotlight, it was the spotlight before they put it out of business and forced it into bankruptcy. But they used to talk, I think they interviewed Taylor Caldwell even. But I think she was a subscriber to the spotlight, if I remember well. So she was a big-time believer in conspiracy. And you're not going to get that many people today. They're certainly going to get a major publisher, I don't know, that are postulating those things. But, there are lots of strange aspects to the McKinley's assassination. And I believe I'm trying to – okay, I'm mixing it up with Harding. I a lot of times, because I don't write that much about it, but I include something about Garfield and about McKinley and Warren Harding as well. So I sometimes get elements of those three mixed up, because although Harding wasn't directly assassinated, his death was certainly curious, to say the least. Died on a cruise and no autopsy done. And That's another thread I noticed when I was writing. I didn't realize, but, you know, when I started looking at all these deaths of these renowned people, you know, Harding died under incredibly suspicious circumstances. Nobody still really knows why. No autopsy. Apparently at the behest of his wife, who I guess, you know, was a leading suspect because of that. And then Calvin Coolidge dies, and I think at 59 or 60, wasn't that old, sudden heart attack. No autopsy. Not in office, but it was even just out of office. Very strange. And FDR, you know, one of the all-time great conspirators, dies suddenly. No autopsy. This is a trend. And so when Joe McCarthy, you know, and Senator Joe McCarthy, one of the most controversial figures of his day, enters Bethesda, you know, you don't want to go to Bethesda Naval Hospital. You know, patriots don't come out alive when they go there. But he went in there with a knee ailment. Had a knee problem. 49 years old with a bum knee. He dies 2 days later. No autopsy. So, and of course, you know, the afterwards, the press, it was, you know, Jack Anderson types, you know, were anxious to pile on this guy and just called him a terrible alcoholic and said he died of alcoholism or maybe hepatitis. There's no evidence or any of that. We don't know. I mean, I think it's the, you know, getting these probably knocked off as his friend Jim Forrestal was. And these are, you know, it's a long hit list. You know, the Clinton body count is pretty impressive, but the overall body count is it's mind-boggling if you look at it.
Well, how right was Joe McCarthy? By the way, just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we're a complete the communists or whatever you want to call them, anti-Americans, anti-constitution. We started off the conversation talking about the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments. I mean, that's the last. Imagine what they could have accomplished had that not been in the way, right? They're trying to get rid of it. But these figures, you know, like just people like Joe McCarthy, I just think, gosh, you know, they were so right on so many things. And then history just, when you cross paths, right, for the power structure, they have a way of getting rid of you. And I think that's why it's funny. We covered, we got about a minute left. We got to 1901 for sure. And then we kind of touched on a little bit of Joe McCarthy. We didn't even talk about FDR, didn't talk about Pearl Harbor. There's so much in this book, ladies and gentlemen. I wanted to have Don on. We did this last minute. We had both had some technical difficulties on our normal radio time. And I'm thinking, let's talk about crimes and cover-ups because I wanted to have you on for a while to do this. And it's so important, you know, go to Amazon.com or wherever books are sold and get a copy, the paperback copy of Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. Don, so great having you on. Let's do this again soon. I want to, you know, again, you got Hidden History 3. You're working on that. Yes. Tell people where they can find you, too, because I want people to be able to find your shows.
Well, okay, you know, the Donald Jeffrey Show is on Ocelli.com every Wednesday live from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern time. And, of course, you're kind enough to put it over on America Unplugged and the Rockfin, the archive shows. And Jeff Rentz, who I appear every Monday night, he's got a big audience on Jeff Rentz Show Mondays at 9 p.m. Eastern. He puts all my archive shows, and I think he runs them four times a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays morning. So they're getting out there everywhere. Of course, I Protest is still barely hanging on to TFR, but that may be moving over here. So we'll be talking more about that. And you can find my writings at DonaldJeffries.news is my blog, and DonaldJeffries.media is my writing at Substack, which I write regularly at. So I'm easy to find out there, and my books are everywhere, and my book on showbiz is coming out next month, too.
The great Donald Jeffries, ladies and gentlemen, Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics. Get the paperback. Help us out. Let's boost those numbers and look forward to Hidden History 3. I'll see you guys Monday for the Arterburn Radio transmission. End of transmission.
Life is a continuous confrontation with forks in the road. One is good, one is bad. And you could always wander completely off the road altogether and become lost. Totally and completely lost. If you take the wrong fork at one of these junctions, there is always the opportunity at the next fork to get back on track. But it is a constant battle within ourselves. You see, I have studied this concept for many, many years, and I have to tell you that if there is a real devil, like Flip Wilson used to say, the devil made me do it. I'm not telling you that there's no such thing as Satan or Lucifer. I'm telling you this. If there really is a devil, that devil exists in the hearts and minds of men and nowhere else. Nowhere else. For if you take man out of the equation, evil ceases to exist. And there is left only the laws of the universe and the balance of nature. Put man in the equation, and before long, evil will rear its ugly head and present itself to the world. The evil is within man, and that is why it was called the fall. The devil never made anyone do it. If you do it, you did it yourself because you fell into temptation. For until man once again confronts the real nature of his own condition and of the world around him and accepts full responsibility for his actions without blaming anyone else or any devil, until then we will always be a puppet on the end of someone else's string. And ladies and gentlemen, when that someone pulls that string, we will dance.